Mmm, the first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.
Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I'm just a caveman.
Due to habeas corpus, you and Miss Bonifante had a common law marriage.
So you don't work on a contingency basis?
No, money down. Oops, shouldn't have this bar association logo here either.
Would you please point at that robot over there? No further questions.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode number 59, and I am host Thomas Smith. That over there is host Andrew Torres. How are you doing, Mr. Torres?
I'm doing great, Thomas. How are you?
I am doing well, okay.
Welcome back to the States.
Yeah. Boy, was the law different over in Europe. It was that was an experience. I had to take a whole different bar exam. No, not really.
I made sure nothing happened.
Oh, yeah, nothing. So nothing significant. Oh, I just got back. Anything, no news, right? Nothing I have to worry about or think about.
I sent all my friends in the Trump administration an email and asked them to make sure nothing would take place during the week while you were overseas.
Oh, so, good. Well,
you see how much pull I have.
Yeah. Sounds like it was a success. I'm sure we had something else planned for this episode, but whatever it was, I'm sure it'll be great and it'll wait for a later episode. But yeah, we've definitely got to talk about the big news, which is Trump deflecting away from anything else that was going on in his presidency. So we'll figure out whether that's legal and all that. But in the meantime, let's first get to our first listener question of the day.
He who questions training only trains himself at asking questions.
What?
T.sp. I don't know what this is. Some username somewhere, but we'll try to give you credit. Whoever T.sp is. I have a question regarding the possible invocation of the nuclear option. Since changing the Senate rules would require a vote, I was wondering whether the vote to end the filibuster could itself be filibustered. It seems like it could. It seems like if it could, the Senate wouldn't be able to muster up the 60 people to get cloture for that vote. So yeah, I guess that's a very procedural question. It's something that you might wonder offhand, well, how can you get rid of something like that without having the 60 votes in itself to get rid of it? So what's the procedural story there, Andrew?
Yeah, and it's actually even more interesting than T.sp suggests. We should be clear, the Senate invoked the nuclear option on Thursday, April 6th, last Thursday, paving the way for the vote on Gorsuch, which took place on Friday, April 7th. In between those two events was the attack on Syria, which we will talk about in the main segment. But if you missed it, yes, indeed, the Senate did invoke the nuclear option, allowing them to confirm Neil Gorsuch with under 60 votes. They had 52 votes for the nuclear option and then 55 votes for Gorsuch. So Gorsuch is now on the Supreme Court. All of our venting and trying to alarm people and get people interested in opposing Neil Gorsuch has turned out to be fairly useless in the long run. But, you know, we did our best. What is the nuclear option? What differentiates the Senate from the House of Representatives is that in the House of Representatives, you have an automatic limit on debating any piece of legislation or action that comes up. Okay. And so when that time limit is up, it goes automatically to a vote. And then there's
so
just
there's
an
no
up or
such
down
thing
vote
as a filibuster in
there,
the
House. They're really, yeah, there's no such thing as a filibuster in the House. And in the Senate, what makes something a filibuster is you reach the end, is that there's no set time limit on how long you can debate something. In order to cut off debate, you have to have a motion, which is called a motion for cloture. And cloture, I'm sure, is some Latin word meaning close.
Yeah, it's to clote it. You need to make yes sure that somebody right clotes it. So
right.
Yeah.
It's related to the Latin root cloaca. No, I have no idea. By long-standing rule of the Senate, that vote in itself requires 60 votes. And so what happens when you can't get 60 votes to call cloture is debate continues. And it used to be, if you've seen, Mr. Smith goes to Washington, yeah, right, yeah, that the implication of, oh, okay, we've cut off debate. We have voted to cut off debate. That failed. Now we have to debate some more. And that's where the yeah idea of the filibuster as, you know, guy Jimmy Stewart yeah reading from the phone book comes into play. In the past 30 years, that hasn't been how filibusters get conducted because filibusters have become so commonplace that the Senate will just sort of
they're like, look,
take
why are we
it
putting,
as a given
doing all this work when we yeah could just not?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And actually what they can do is they can move to the next piece of business, even though no action has been taken on the prior piece of business. That was the procedural rule that needed to be put into place. So that's why, even though to pass a law, you only require 51 votes, to actually call the vote requires 60. Now, T.Spa asks a really interesting question, which is, what about changing the rule that requires the filibuster itself? Wouldn't that itself be subject to debate?
Now, the first thing I have to say is, obviously, this is like, why are there still monkeys if we evolved from monkeys? Like, obviously, there's a reason. Otherwise, T.Spa wouldn't be the first person to think of this, but clearly there is a reason, so let's have it. What is it?
It's actually much more complicated than you would think. As it turns out, a vote to change a prior rule that is in effect in the Senate doesn't require 50 votes, doesn't require 60 votes, actually requires 67 votes.
Ah, okay? super majority.
Yeah, it's even harder to change the rules than it is to filibuster.
Wow.
So you might be saying, well, this sounds fantastic and all, but you just said the Republicans were able to change the rule. So how did they do that? And the answer is that they relied on a very, very little used and controversial procedure in which the chair of the Senate would declare that a particular procedure was was in this case unconstitutional, right? So the chair would declare that requiring 60 votes for confirming a Supreme Court nominee is unconstitutional, and that the appropriate constitutional remedy was, in this case, the fact that the Democrats had used a version of this nuclear option back in 2013 to confirm a number of federal judges who were getting basically the Gorsuch treatment from the Republican Senate. They were filibustering for over 6 months on confirming a whole slate of federal court judges. And so the last time the Democrats controlled the Senate, they used in 2013, they used a version of this nuclear option to confirm a bunch of federal judges. And I should say, as we go through this, if the Democrats had controlled the Senate in 2016, there's no doubt in my mind they would have used the right nuclear option to confirm Gorsuch, right? Like if there had been, suppose there had been a changeover and, you know, I mean, you can figure out a scenario under which the shoe is on the other foot. But so what you have to do for the nuclear option is the chair declares that a particular procedure is unconstitutional, recommends a different procedure in its place. That then either goes unchallenged, which doesn't happen, or is challenged by the minority, which brings up the provision of, appeal to the decision of the chair. And under Robert's rules of order, an appeal to the decision of the chair requires only a majority line vote. Okay. So what the nuclear option is a way of saying, we think this prior rule is unconstitutional. We are going to replace it with this other rule. And in so doing, that vote itself only requires a majority vote.
What a stupid rule. Boy, yes. It really is like senators hate this one weird trick to
get
your, wow.
Well, and you're probably going to ask if the answer to a sort of reduction to absurdity, right? Because that's where we were otherwise headed, right? If every procedural vote itself required cloture, then everything would ultimately require 60 votes, right? Like you would never get around it. You would just be like, oh, well, then I'll filibuster that vote, right? And the answer is rules changes don't require, you know, procedural stuff doesn't require cloture because there's no formal debate on it. This is all part of Robert's Rules of Order. But if everything can be reduced down, if the way you avoid that reductio is by ultimately getting to something that requires a 51-49 vote, then isn't there really no protection left in the Senate, right? Couldn't the Democrats, as soon as they assume control of the Senate, invoke the exact same nuclear option procedure to get rid of the filibuster entirely? And the answer is yes. Yes, they could. And so we were asked about this back in the delightful and heady old days in which people would send us questions in September of 2016 about what President Hillary Clinton and the Democratic Senate were going to do in 2017. Yeah. And you may recall we were asked, should the Democrats exercise the nuclear option to confirm either
Merrick Garland or whoever? Yeah, Hillary decided, yeah.
Right. And I, happy for consistency, opined that no, I think she shouldn't. Because, you know, truly sort of once you've done this, I don't believe that the traditional filibuster on legislative matters is going to last the next session. I think the next time the Democrats get control of the Senate and they have a Democratic president, which again, I hope is as early as 2020, I think they will look at this sort of litany of past wrongs and say, you know, well, by God, we're not going to be played for chumps again. You know, they took a Supreme Court nominee away from us. They essentially filibustered 6 out of 8 years of our last Democratic president, and we're not going to let that happen.
You know, some people might be thinking, why wouldn't the Republicans just do that now? And I don't know if we have the same answer for that, but I did manage to keep up to date on some stuff while I was in Europe. And I heard an interesting discussion on one of my many podcasts that Republicans actually just would not want that because they're already having a hard enough time passing health care when they have the majority. Like, they can't decide on what they want. They don't agree. So being able to blame Democrats and saying, well, we just couldn't get the 60 votes. And so therefore that's, you know, that's Democrats. Oh, they held us up, darn it. And so I, based on this analysis, it actually makes sense to me. I'm curious what your thoughts are, that Republicans don't want to do that because they don't really have the same kind of cohesive agenda that Democrats have. Whereas Democrats, if they got back control of the Senate, they'd be like, okay, let's get rid of that filibuster. Let's pass a better healthcare bill. Let's do this. Let's do that. There's a lot more things that I think Democrats agree on. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I can sign on to that analysis. I mean, I think the Republican Party right now is an uneasy alliance of several parties, right? Like you have whatever Trump's Republicans are, right? The sort of populist knee-jerk, I don't know, I'm not going to try and characterize them, but whatever they are, right? You have the Tea Party faction, the hardcore, hard right Christian conservatives. And then you have the kind of a loose amalgam of, you know, people who have historically been like, where do you put Bob Corker? Where do you put, you know, I mean, Susan Collins obviously is the last, like, you know, sort of potentially moderate to mainstream kind of New England business Republican. But whatever, you put all those people that you don't know what group to put them in group three. They're very, very good at being an opposition party. There's not a lot that they agree on. Neil Gorsuch is somebody they all agree on, right? Like, I mean, he is, if you are a Republican of any of those stripes, I mean, he is, you know, your dream candidate. So it is not surprising to me that they would want to see that advance. But making it easier for Trump to get his legislative agenda crossed, I tend to see a lot of merit in your position. The other thing is, you know, we went through this on the gerrymandering. There's sort of a sense, it's kind of a playground fight sort of mentality. Like if you've ever watched two like 7 year olds fight on the playground, like basically like one kid will shove the other kid and then there'll be sort of a pause and then the other kid will shove that kid back. Right. And then, yeah. And then they just sort of, you know, are in that kind of delayed shoving match. Right. And that's kind of what politics feels like right now, that, that there's one side feels slighted. And so they shove back as hard as they can. And then the other side sort of collects itself and waits to shove back. And the,
yeah, it's really annoying. I mean, I have my biases. I don't think Democrats are perfect, but I boy, do I hate Mitch McConnell. And I think that the childishness, like you mentioned, of just this idea of it's either to one side, it's hypocrisy. And then the other side is, well, you did it first. And that's all it is. Like, there, you just switch it. Like, you look at the Republicans, you're like, well, you know, this is hypocrisy. They said, you know, we couldn't do this earlier. And then their excuse is, well, you guys did it first, so we're doing it now. And it's like, at a certain point, there's so many of these back and forth that you wonder, like, does it matter who struck first? Are we gonna go back to the 80s or the 1800s? Or we're like, how will we figure that out? When will it end? And the answer is never. That's my answer. It will never get any better. But anyway.
Yeah. No, I think that's exactly right. And, you know, again, I mean, I was trying to draw the analogy with our gerrymandering episode, but when the Democrats were in power, you know, in particular, we were looking at the Texas case, they absolutely drew the legislative maps in Texas in such a way as to keep more Democratic legislators in power than reflected the population. And so, you know, as soon as the Republicans got in, they were like, well, by God, that's not going to stand. Right. And they redrew the map to elect as many Republicans as possible. And now, you know, I think of the like 35 member delegation from the House of Representatives in Texas. Isn't it something like 34 Democrats? I mean, it's amazing.
Wow.
In terms of what they've been able to do with the Red Map software and a chip on your shoulder. I don't know. I would love to see something that would be able to kind of diffuse that tension, but I don't see, I don't see what it was. I read a report. I'm not sure if you saw the same report about a supposed, this was a Politico story. I will link it in the show notes about a kind of, Gang of Eight, like group of senators that were trying to save, the filibuster, prevent the nuclear option. And at the end of the day, the first condition by one side, you know, by the Republican side was, well, okay, all the Democrats on this list have to vote for Neil Gorsuch. Okay. I'm not surprised that the effort to compromise failed there when your idea of compromise is, how about we get what we want and you shut up and like it? But we've wandered a little bit away from the question. The question was, doesn't everything require debate and cloture? And the answer is no, procedural rules don't. They require actually even more votes unless you decide to exercise this procedural bit of trickery. But this procedural bit of trickery has gone down without a hitch. And so one of the things that I think is as near an ironclad rule in politics is, if somebody doesn't pay for it the first time around, then no one's going to pay for it the next time, right? Like there will be no repercussions. If Democrats somehow manage to retake the Senate in 2018, and you've done an SIO on what an uphill climb that is.
Yeah.
But if they do, and the democratically controlled Senate refuses a Trump nominee who shows up, you know, in December of 2019. Mitch McConnell will say, well, you know, our precedent was only for the last year of a presidency, and right. Donald Trump has 13 months, or, you know, Mike Pence or whoever it is at that point. I don't really think that the Democratic Senate will be like, well, that's
it'll be Jared Kushner, but yeah.
Yeah.
Somehow.
Yeah. I don't think that the Democratic Senate is going to be like, well, that's an excellent point. So yeah, you got him in December. Okay. We'll have a vote. No, obviously they're going to do back to the Republicans what the Republicans did.
This is going on a while, but another thing that I found really annoying about all the punditry was the idea that, oh, Democrats just should not have done this because, you know, now Trump's going to have his way with the Supreme Court justice nominee. And as you've pointed out, like, it doesn't really get worse than Gorsuch. Like, he's already about as bad as it gets. So my opinion, based on what I've learned from you and other sources, is, yeah, I'm glad we made them pull the nuclear option. It was the only thing that Democrats could have done. There was a slight chance that maybe you could have gotten a couple principled Republicans to not do it or something. You had to do it. There was no downside. It was a stolen seat. Or rather, it was all downside. There was no, it was lose-lose. Yeah. So it's like, yeah. You might as well make them do it, and then maybe you can use that later on for something.
Yeah, and let's go very quickly. Look, we discussed this in OA 40, in which we first discussed Neil Gorsuch. Are there worse nominees? Sure, right? Roy Moore would be a worse nominee. But there's sort of two things to remember on Supreme Court nominees, right? The first is, it's hard to imagine how any of those worse nominees, in terms of being less intellectually and academically qualified, would give you more of what you want, right? Like, you have 100% of what you want in terms of right-wing activism, right? There is no position that is going to come before the Supreme Court for which Roy Moore is going to be a better vote than Neil Gorsuch. That's part of what makes him so frightening. And number two,
they could just use the nuclear option then, by the way. Well, that was what I was going to say, but yeah.
Well, but remember, part of what made Gorsuch so dangerous were his academic credentials, right? Like, the last time that, you know, we talked about this with President Bush failing to get a Supreme Court nominee, and the reason there was because that nominee lacked the academic credentials to be on the court. So the only people that I could envision would be worse sitting on the court would be people that would be harder to fight for, and thus politically, from the Democratic perspective, a quote better nominee because that person would be someone we would have a better chance to take down. So I mean that's a very long-winded way, which is to say an Andrew way of my agreeing with you.
Yeah. Well, credit to T.Spa, though. I mean, it was a complicated thing. I mean, ultimately, obviously, the answer had to be what it was, but that is a lot more confusing than I would have necessarily thought. So thanks, T.Spa, whoever you are, for your question. Let's find out whether or not we're going to impeach Donald Trump for his illegal attack on Syria. Is that about to happen? Or are we just moments away from that?
Not as such. We received this question from a number of sources. And what I want to do in analyzing the attack on Syria is put myself in the position of envisioning that this was President Hillary Clinton who had ordered the strike. And in fact, I mean, one of the criticisms I have of this as a mode of public policy is that one of the few actual public policy positions Donald Trump took during the 2016 election was to criticize Hillary Clinton's long-stated preference to maintain a no-fly zone over Syria. He did so loudly.
Yeah,
in
we
the
can't
debates.
Have that no-fly zone because it would be such a threat to Russia. So we definitely can't do that. It would start World War III because then, yeah.
God,
so frustrating.
I certainly didn't agree with Trump's criticism, which basically was, I don't see why we should be involved in Syria. We should let Russia handle that, which is pretty much what he said. But I do agree with the critique that Rand Paul offered way back in one of the very earliest Republican debates, in which the same question came up, and they were debating the no-fly zone. And Rand Paul said, "You do know maintaining a no-fly zone over Syria means being willing to shoot down Russian jets, because the Russians are flying over Syria. That's what a no-fly zone means. It's not like the Syrians have a massive air force that we're, you know,"
yeah, but my response was always like, of course this would be negotiated. It's right. Not as though, we could argue about the policy and whether or not it would actually work. I would argue that Hillary had some insight into this that maybe I didn't have, being as you know, her years of experience as a Secretary of State. But it's not as though they were going to just drop those there the next day and shoot down every Russian jet. I'm sure there would be negotiated process of doing it, which was why I was so frustrated with that criticism. Sure, criticize the policy if you don't think it's a good idea, but the hyperbole of that it's instantly going to start World War III was, to me, very frustrating.
Oh, I don't mean to suggest that it is an instant, you know, go to World War III, yeah. Do not pass go, do not collect $200, but that it is an immeasurably destabilizing and aggressive action. And, you know, as I said, I anticipated being here criticizing Hillary Clinton.
Hey, you know what it might have done, though? Might have stopped that chemical weapon airstrike that was delivered in the air. So,
well,
you have to measure both sides of the ledger. Yep. Sure, it could have caused a lot of tension, and it's not the most straightforward thing, but it would stop airstrikes on civilians. So that's what a no-fly zone would have done. But anyway.
Yep. So in any event, that's the position that I'm putting myself in. And as we go through this, I am of the opinion that President Trump's authority to unilaterally declare airstrikes in Syria is, as far as I can tell, a constitutional exercise. Yeah. I didn't want to put in a drum roll because I'm not thrilled about defending Donald Trump on the show, as everyone knows. But I think it's at least as constitutional an exercise of the executive's commander-in-chief authority as anything that's been undertaken out of the executive office in the past 35 years.
Yeah. Because we've talked about this way back when, the fact that the old argument that's always trotted out is, wait a minute, you need Congress's approval to declare war. And I'm guessing you're going to refresh us a little bit on this, because if I remember right, your answer was, well, we don't really ever declare war anymore. That doesn't really happen. We just have these certain things. Yeah, go ahead.
I looked up, let me try this one on for size.
Hmm.
How many times do you think Congress has declared war in American history?
Once.
Well,
really low.
It's kind of numbers either really, really low or really, really high. I like one. The answer is five, right?
Five.
Beginning with the War of 1812. And none since
answer was it was just going to be the Revolutionary
War. Right.
And then they never did it again.
Yeah.
But
no,
anyway. Yeah, anyway
right. So let me take a step back and sort of ground the powers that are at stake here. Right. So Article 2, Section 1 says that the executive power shall be vested in a president of the United States of America. And Section 2 says the president shall be commander in chief of the Army and Navy of the United States and of the militia of the several states when called into the actual service of the United States. And that provides the sort of ill-defined power to the president to run the nation's military. He is constrained on the other side by several propositions, the largest of which that pertains to what we just discussed is Article 1, Section 8, and it is Clause 11, even though the Constitution doesn't number these, which grants to Congress the power to declare war, grant letters of marque and reprisal, and make rules concerning captures on land and water. So historically, that has been understood as Congress declares war and the president gets to prosecute the war. And so the question is, where does a one-off military strike fall into the intersection of these two provisions? So the answer to that historically is it's fallen under the general aggregated power of the president to act as commander in chief and to have the powers of the executive. And historically, we have seen that presidents, particularly in the past 30 years, have said that these clauses do not constrain them from engaging in military action that is short of declaring war. And attorneys general have argued additionally that what the legislature maintains, what Congress retains, is the power to fund the military, right? So in any event, if you had the president sort of going rogue and acting beyond the scope of the delegated authority under the Constitution, yes, obviously, if the president acts beyond the Constitution, you can impeach the president. We've talked about the difficulties in doing that. We're going to hit that in the third segment on the show. But it's easier than impeaching the president is just cutting off the funds for that particular military action. And that vote came up several times during the Iraq War, which, again, no declaration of war. There was a 2001 authorization for the use of military force, which I'm going to get to in a minute. But the Congress was free to cut funds, and they didn't. There were many votes that came up. There were some that attracted a plurality of Democrats. But at the end of the day, part of the kind of checks and balances here of saying we don't need a judicial determination that the president has gone too far in his executive powers in ordering bombings is we can just say, hey, you know what? We're not gonna pay for those bombs. And the Congress maintains the absolute authority to do that. I'm going to link in the show notes a bunch of different things. But one of the things that I'm going to link is a document written by Walter Dellinger, who was White House counsel in 1994 to Bill Clinton regarding the use of targeted military strikes against targets in Haiti. And Dellinger said the president complied with the War Powers Act, which I'm about to describe in a minute. And after examining the circumstances, nature, scope, and duration of the anticipated deployment, we determined that this was not a, quote, war in the constitutional sense. Specifically, the planned development was to take place with the full consent of legitimate government and did not involve the risk of major or prolonged hostilities or serious casualties to either the United States or Haiti. For those reasons, we concluded that the president had legal and constitutional authority to order United States troops to be deployed into Haiti. So there were actually some boots on the ground. I think there were helicopters that were also deployed in the Haiti
helicopter area. Boots.
Right. So that's sort of the backdrop. I mentioned the War Powers Act. That is 50 USC 1541 et sec. This was passed in 1973 at the end of the Vietnam War and at the end of the rather tumultuous presidency of Richard Nixon, in which Congress said, as a declaration of policy, this is, let me read it to you. This is 1541A. It is the purpose of this chapter to fulfill the intent of the framers of the Constitution of the United States and ensure that the collective judgment of both the Congress and the President will apply to the introduction of United States armed forces into hostilities or into situations where the imminent involvement in hostilities is clearly indicated by the circumstances and the continued use of such forces in hostilities or in such situations. So you may recall the Vietnam War was an undeclared war. So Congress said, hey, look, we are passing this War Powers Act to reclaim for ourselves and take away from the president the open-ended authority to just, you know, wage the bloodiest war in American history in terms of loss of American lives without a formal declaration of war. Okay, well, fine. If declarations of war are now sort of relegated to the ash bin of history, that's fine, but we still want to assert our role in given oversight. And what that requires is, this is section 1544, that the president submit a report to congressional committees and that within 60 calendar days after a report is submitted or required to be submitted, the president shall terminate the use of forces with respect to which such report was submitted or required to be submitted unless the Congress, one, has declared war or enacted a specific authorization of such use of United States Armed Forces, two, has extended by law the 60-day period, or three is physically unable to meet as a result of an armed attack on the United States. Okay. So what this says is if the president wants to use military force, he's got to submit a report to Congress, but then he's got 60 days and he has to terminate his activity unless Congress either declares war, grants a special authorization of military force, or, you know, was blown off the face of the map by, you know. And that seems to make it pretty clear to me that one-off activities that require less than 60 days are presumptively valid under the War Powers Act.
Yeah.
I would add, you will not be surprised. There are no successful cases that involve lawsuits against sitting presidents regarding the use of military force. There have been efforts. So Campbell versus Clinton was an effort to challenge President Bill Clinton's use of airstrikes in former Yugoslavia. And O'Connor versus United States, 2003 decision, challenging George W. Bush's war in Iraq. And both of those cases were decided on other grounds, but it remains the case. You know, we always ask this question, right? Because I've said the first place we look to for understanding the significance of the meaning of constitutional terms is the
history
and jurisprudence. And what we can tell from previous cases is that there have been no successful efforts at blocking a president's use of military force, either under the constitutional provisions or under the 1973 War Powers Act. And so as I read kind of the at least ambiguity, and I would argue, you know, there's kind of a 60-day safe harbor period, plus the prior memoranda that have been submitted by both Democratic and Republican White House counsel, I think this is a legitimate exercise of the president's authority as commander in chief. Now, you know, we can question the wisdom. We should question the wisdom every day of giving a game show host with no political experience control over the most powerful military on the face of the planet. But we did that, right? And elections have consequences. And
Because when you give them control of that military, Syrian bomber planes will be inconvenienced for almost an hour, maybe 2 hours. So that's the kind of raw power that this administration wields. They can severely delay. That's the most frustrating part about this whole thing to me. They couldn't even just destroy the entire airfield. They put the airfield out of commission for, like, I don't know, half a day or something. Like, we spent millions to do that. So I had to make a joke there, but it is very frustrating. At the very least, could you at least demolish the target that you're going for?
I would think if the objective is to eliminate the future ability of the Assad government to deliver chemical weapons, what you would want to do is strike at their chemical weapons facilities and shorehouses and strike at their air force that is delivering said chemical weapons.
But no. So anyway, different story though. Yeah, but yeah, I suspected the answer to this was legal because, we've seen every president for what? I'm not that old, but I remember going back when Clinton would do this kind of thing. You already referenced it. I don't remember, and I was a little young, but I don't remember congressional authority for every single one of those little cruise missile strikes that Clinton did to distract from the blowjobs he was getting. But I would imagine that having seen this president do this for decades now, that it would have been surprising for it to not be legal to me.
Anyway. Yeah. And let me add one bad argument that I think has been made. It was made by Senator John McCain, who, of course, has not met military intervention that he does not want, has argued that this was expressly authorized by the 2001 authorization for the use of military force in Iraq. I will link that in the show notes. I can read you the entire authorization because it's two paragraphs long. And it says, the president is authorized to use all necessary and appropriate force against those nations, organizations, or persons he determines planned, authorized, committed, or aided the terrorist attacks that occurred on September 11th, 2001, or harbored any such organizations or persons in order to prevent any future acts of international terrorism against the United States by such nations, organizations, or persons. And then there is the paragraph
does
B.
Does he think it falls into that, like preventing? But it sounded to me like that was attached to if you were harboring terrorists who committed 9/11, right?
Yeah, well, it says he determined, planned, authorized, committed, or aided the terrorist attacks that occurred on September 11th, 2001. And then there is a subparagraph B that says, by the way, this is intended to constitute specific statutory authorization within the meaning of the War Powers Resolution, right? So that's it. I think it is an untenable reading of the War Powers Act.
Because that would allow you to do anything anywhere in the Middle East, really. If the authorization for Iraq allows you to attack Syria when there's no connection to 9/11, then unless he's trying to allege that, that would be alarming to me if that allows you to attack any country and essentially in the area.
Yeah. And the provocation for this, again, if we were talking about a different president, there's absolutely nothing wrong. It is actually a continuation of the Clinton doctrine to say that we will strike against and disable a regime from using chemical weapons against its own people. Right. That's a perfectly legitimate international goal of the United States. But that does not have a plausible, tenable connection to preventing future acts of international terrorism. And the statements being made by the administration, to their credit, right? They are not saying we undertook this to prevent future terrorism. They're saying, look, there was a terrible chemical weapons attack, and we did this to make sure there aren't subsequent chemical weapons attacks.
Yep.
Taken at face value, that justification is consistent with the acts of the United States of the past 40 years, and in my view, complies with the operative legal requirements. So make America great again, is I think what I'm saying.
I knew it. I saw him wearing the hat. No. All right. Thanks for keeping us honest. I suspected that was the answer, and let's attack Trump the right way. Let's make sure to keep logic and facts on our side. But all right, thanks for taking us through that. And now we have our favorite segment, one of our favorite segments, and let's hit that music right now.
Because people have got to know whether or not their president's a crook.
Nobody, so you're not aware of any context during the course of the election?
How many times do I have to answer this question?
Can you just say
Russia
yes or no
is
on
a
it?
Ruse. Yeah, I know you have to get up and ask a question so important. Russia is a ruse.
Well, I'm not a crook.
We just heard our favorite song, and that was the Yodeler. And so that's how you know that we're going to talk about the fact that the clear path I'm sure we have to impeach Donald Trump, right? Right? Right?
Yeah, well, I want to keep my streak alive. So having defended Donald Trump, I think in all three segments of this show, as I'm about to do,
closet conservative.
That means I don't know where all our all the people who hate tweeted us will go, but there were no procedural defects in Neil Gorsuch getting on the Supreme Court. We just discussed Syria, and something that is making the rounds in our circles is a Robert Reich video that is the five grounds for impeaching Donald Trump.
I'm glad we have five. Wow.
Yeah, I will link
it
in the show.
It could have only been one or two, but it turns out it's five. I can't wait.
In fact, I'm going to let you tackle these. So here are Robert Reich's five grounds for why Donald Trump can be impeached. Number one, Article 2, Section 2 requires the president to faithfully execute the office of president of the United States. That's the presidential oath clause. And he is not doing so because he has accused Obama of impeachable and illegal activity with no evidence. Those are the wiretapping claims. How do you rate that as a ground for impeachment?
Well, I'm going to do the disappointing thing that you have done to me every single time anyone's asked any of these questions, which is, well, impeachable acts are whatever the Congress decides is an impeachable act. So if somehow, if the Republicans all of a sudden woke up in some sort of body switch situation where they all decided, like a Freaky Friday scenario where they all had changed brains and decided that that accusing Obama of wiretapping was a high crime and a misdemeanor, technically, yeah, it could be impeachable, but it sounds pretty thin otherwise to me.
Yeah, I have to say, if I were a member of a democratically held House of Representatives right now, and those were the grounds for impeachment that were drawn up before me, I don't know that I could vote for that.
Yeah.
I would not want, I mean, look, it's tough to say, I trust in the American people not to elect a callow moron as president. But the idea that a president could be impeached for the things he says about his predecessor, I wouldn't want to set that precedent, right? Like, yeah. I know how I felt as a Democrat in 2008. And certainly,
because Mitch McConnell will take it further the next time around, by the way. Once that impeachment happens, then it'll be, the president looked at somebody the wrong way. And then, started this.
Yeah. I mean, if you impeach President Trump for saying bad things about his predecessor, I mean, that's essentially what this comes down to. If you say that constitutes a high crime or misdemeanor, then yeah, I would be very, very concerned about what, President Elizabeth Warren is going to do in 2020, January 2021, in describing the mess that she's going to inherit from President Trump, right? So, I agree presidents ought not to do this.
Well, time,
okay,
it is a little weird. I know it's something we've already talked about, but it's so hard to grasp with the fact that Trump can just accuse his predecessor of a literal crime, like actually fabricate a crime that Obama did, and there's no consequences other than, sooner or later after he's ruined the world, then we'll vote him out of of office. It is hard to believe that that's the only recourse. So I guess I what I'm saying is I don't blame I don't know Robert Reich, but I don't blame him
former
for
former Secretary of Labor under President Clinton. First Secretary of Labor, or possibly the Treasury. I think he was Secretary of the Treasury. Unimpeachable liberal credentials. I like the guy. He's sort of taken up the gadfly role right now, but I just think this is a step too far. And with respect to that, Donald Trump led a convention in which chants of lock her up were led from the stage throughout the Republican National Convention. So I don't really know why we should be surprised that rhetoric has continued. I mean, one of the things, you and I have said sort of since Trump became president is all of these are things that he promised to do. I mean, the wiretapping is new, but the demonizing your political opponent, I mean, that's part of what people liked about Trump that got him put into office. I don't know what the long-term fix for that is. It's certainly bad.
So that's pretty frustrating. So anyway, that's the answer to that one. Really would be, I agree with you though. I mean, that would be setting a difficult precedent that I wouldn't be too comfortable with.
Reich's second ground is our old friend, the Emoluments Clause, Section 9. And here he points to two supporting pieces of evidence. The first is the decision in China that came sort of serendipitously soon after the election to approve various Trump trademark applications that had previously been pending. And the second is steering foreign diplomats and others looking to curry favor with the president to Trump hotels. And do those count as foreign emoluments? And I would say, again, we did two episodes on the Foreign Emoluments Clause, leaving aside the legal argument that was raised that I think neither you nor I were persuaded by. Right. I would describe the classic application of the emoluments clause, and so did you, and so did Professor Tillman, as, you know, Russians give you a bag of money. That's what it was sort of meant to cover. Mm-hmm. So if those are the paradigmatic cases, I think that the foreign business entanglements, again, are something that I would look at as being resolvable through the political process, right? Like, if you elect a guy, and again, remember, Trump ran on "I'm too rich to be corrupted," which is the most preposterous assertion I've ever heard. But I mean, he expressly ran on "I'm a rich guy with hotels all over the world," and you know, the fact that the Democrats didn't make a very good case against this, and the fact that voters were like, "Oh yeah, well, I'm sure that when he's president, despite the fact that he's, you know, disclosed basically nothing about these businesses around, I'm sure it'll all be fine." I really view a lot of that entanglements as, you know, sort of the being on the fault of the voter, right? Like it we were supposed to. It's why it's been a tradition for presidents to release their tax returns, and we talked about that. But it should have been the argument should have been presented clearly of, you know, here is somebody with, you know, a leviathan of international financial agreements who has done everything in his power to be as opaque about them as possible. And we can't give somebody like that executive power, right? That's the political argument, because we've now given that person executive power, and it's beyond obvious that he's using that power to, you know, enrich himself and his immediate family and his tiny inner circle of cronies, and that's it. I think that is a difficult case to make to even a hostile House of Representatives, that would constitute a violation of the Emoluments Clause. Although I would say that's the best of the arguments of these four, is the Emoluments Clause. And certainly, okay, you know, if we had a Democratic legislature, you could see that legislature passing specific guidelines right now that would restrict future entanglements. And I suspect, by the way, regardless of who the next president is, that we will see that, right? I mean, we have a history in this country of passing legislation to, you know, lock the barn door after the horse has long escaped. I suspect that we will see future legislation that specifically says a president using his influence to promote his business interest. But, you know, but we don't have those laws right now. We don't have that guidance. We just have, you know, that single line in the Constitution. And again, I don't know if you had a Democratic Congress, I don't know that would be sufficient.
Right. This next one I think is particularly weak, unless I'm maybe I'm not reading it right, but it just says the Muslim ban having violated the First Amendment. So are we to believe from this Robert Reich guy that if you propose or if you do an executive order that's struck down by the courts, that would be an impeachable offense? That
yeah, it really is the argument he's making, and it sounded outrageous to
me. That's
too
absurd. Yeah. I mean, how much stuff did Obama have struck down by courts? I mean, parts of Obamacare,
right?
He tried to do certain. I mean, what would just once you do something that a court decides is unconstitutional or doesn't hold up, then we get to impeach you? That cannot be. That can't be right.
I agree, but that is the argument that he was making, and that's why that's a bad one. See, like I said, you should take this.
And then same goes for four, I'm guessing, right? Because he's threatened to abridge. Number four is he's threatened to abridge the freedom of the press.
Right, and that is again, the cowering of journalists. And look,
these are all bad things. Yeah, exactly. Go ahead. We're just going to say the same stuff. So
yeah, you say it.
Well, okay, I'll say it. I mean, these are all bad things. This is not to by any means endorse any of these things, but there has to be a standard of what's actually impeachable. Otherwise, you're just going to go back and forth impeaching each other's, you know, party's president for stuff that you don't agree with rather than stuff that's actually a high crime or a misdemeanor. And as far as the abridging freedom of the press thing goes, I mean, we shouldn't get into it, but I mean, there was some stuff Obama did early in his administration that was actually not entirely dissimilar from some of the stuff that Trump has done. And I know that can be uncomfortable to hear, but he did a lot of stuff like that early on that people looked at as abridging the freedom of the press. And I don't think it was impeachable for him, and I don't think it's impeachable for Trump.
Yeah, and I think I know to what you are referring. I would want a Democratic president to be free at a press conference to look at a flack from Fox News or from Breitbart and say, that's a ridiculous question. Don't come in here with your partisan crap. And I'm going to call on a real reporter now. Right. And I think that's perfectly legitimate to do. And so it's preposterous that Donald Trump's definition of what constitutes fake news is anybody but Breitbart.
Yeah.
But again, you know, when you draw the line of the president kicking out various members of the press or singling out individual reporters or news institutions by name, you know, again, we gotta play by the same rules on both sides. And there are certainly, if I were president, like there's no way, I mean, there's no chance I'll ever be president, but there's no way I'm not gonna, you know, I'm not gonna stand there for a question from some idiot at Breitbart. I'm gonna be like, that question's ridiculous. Next question.
Yeah, yeah.
And yes, the fact that Trump is using those techniques on, you know, Wolf Blitzer or whatever, like, is kind of ridiculous. But not.
Well, Wolf Blitzer deserves it, but anybody else? No, I know what you mean. All right, what is number five? I don't even know that I understand this one. You'll
well, the last one was one. Just Reich saying, and possibly a fifth if we uncover yeah. evidence that he...
Was this the old round number provision?
Yeah, it was the...
And because I didn't want to do four. Yeah.
If we find evidence that he, you know, conspired with the Russians to subvert the election.
Why don't we go through 10, yeah. through 100, if we find yeah. evidence that he killed somebody? If we find evidence...
Yeah. Yeah, and look, like, if there is evidence that Donald Trump or operatives in his campaign conspired with the Russians to fix the election, then I would agree that impeachment is a proper remedy. But we're not there yet, Francis. Like, so I was not overly impressed with the Reich video. I'm still a fan. I am glad that he's a voice out here on the left. But one of the things that you and I have continually beat the drum about are, you know, sort of number one, making sure that you're making good and factual arguments on our side. And number two, that, you know, that those arguments, you're cognizant of how those arguments swing both ways.
Yeah, I really don't like stuff like this. I mean, on the left, I said this on Serious Inquiries Only very early into Trump's presidency, or even maybe before he assumed office, that I was worried, and I'm very disturbed that fake news is more a product of who's in power than it is left or right. I hope that's not true. I hope we can say that there's more fake news on the right and the left is, you know, going to be closer to reality in general. But stuff like this, it's not helping. So let's tidy it up a little bit, left. Stop with the sources that are clearly just talking out of their behinds and not really, they don't really know what they're talking about. So that's my quick two cents on that.
I agree.
So I guess the answer is the yodeler practically fell down the mountain a little bit more. I mean, this is just not even close after this. I mean, but we'll have to stay tuned. We'll keep an eye on that yodeler and maybe someday in 20... Never. No, that's not happening. He will be, after looking at the 2018 midterms, my adjusted belief is that he will lose in 2020 before he's impeached. My prediction, again, hold me to this, but I don't think that's ever going to happen. It would be great if it did, but I think he will lose in 2020 and that'll be how we get rid of Trump. So whatever. We'll see.
That's where my prediction has been.
Yeah, you were right. You were right. Sorry. I was hoping 2018 would do something. It could. It's a tiny possibility if everybody hates Trump. If his approval rating is like 30 or in the 20s, it's possible that people just don't come out and vote, even though the map is way in the, or not the map, but the elections that are up in 2018 are way favorable to Republicans. It's possible, like, it could be a landslide the other way because there's so much energy. And hey, let's all hope for that, but it's going to be a difficult road.
Here's the way to summarize it based off your episode of Serious Inquiries Only and the way that I have been giving it as a shorthand to folks, which is the Democrats have to hold on to all of their seats.
Yep.
They have to pick up two tough races, and then they either have to win in Utah and defeat Orrin Hatch, or in Texas and defeat Ted Cruz. And, you know,
Texas is a tiny possibility. It's a weird state now, but you never
it,
know.
Can you come up with it? You can come up with a scenario. But
even if we win, if we keep all of ours and win two, it's still not enough, unfortunately. So, correct. Yeah, like you said, yeah. we have to.
You got to, if you want to believe Democratic Senate, you have to believe Ted Cruz losing his seat. Now look.
Oh, I would love to.
We will.
That would go. You know what? Nothing in my heart will ever, you know, will ever heal the wound that is the fact that Trump, you know, assumed the highest office of the land. That never will be fully healed. But Democrats taking back the Senate with Ted Cruz losing his seat, it would go a little way. I would accept that as a okay. You know, I'm speaking to the universe again. We're now on speaking terms, because that would be pretty great.
The universe does owe us a couple do overs, doesn't it?
Oh no, yeah. Kidding! I'm not talking to the universe. But anyway, that's our the analysis there. Thanks for taking us through that, Andrew. I chipped in a little bit. I think I've learned enough from you over the 8 months or so. But yeah. Anyway. Thanks for that. And now we'll have to thank our new patrons. And they are Zach Attack from the Back. Nice. Deborah, thank you. Jessica Wilson, Alistair Licton, I think. AIG787, Alexis Crone, Gerardo Garcia, Torsten Skurve, Eric Durso, thank you. Daniel Fisher, Joseph Strickland, Kathy Ross, Trey Beard, and Grunting Frog. Thank you guys very much.
Thanks. I left Thanks you this for one. Cutting on this one. Yeah.
I don't thank know if you. We can. This is a children's program. I don't know if we can. Yeah.
Thank you to Smalley Size when he engages in a particular activity. Thank you to Emily, to Ryan B, to Jeff McLeod, to Pledge Edit, to Adopt a Homeless Pet and Oppose Declawing and Ear Docking. So again, you can use your pledges, your pledge edits for causes that happens to be a good cause we agree with. Thank you to Kaylin Turner, to Eric Schnobelin, to Dylan Barnett, Karen Sheets. Thank you to Stephanie. Thank you to Beth Deitch. And thank you, Dano G. Thanks to all of you for supporting us on patreon.com/law. All of your support is what helps make the show possible. And we really appreciate it.
Absolutely. And we are inching ever closer to those new goals. So get us there, guys, and enjoy the Lot Awful Movies in the process. Oh, and if you want to hear, by the way, Lot Awful Movies number 4 with Sam from Comedy Shoeshine, go over to the Comedy Shoeshine feed where that is there. And I'm sure that one was great, and I'm sure you're going to want more. And if you do want more, make sure to pledge to patreon.com/law.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
It is time to find out whatever question I answered way back before I had a life-changing experience in Europe. Now I've decided if I get enough wrong, I'll just say that, you know, my vacation in Europe has caused me to no longer wish to pursue the law. But that'll be my excuse I'll keep later on. But until that happens, how did I do? Let's find out.
Okay. You were, going into this question, 10 out of 17.
Mm.
And this question was an oddly prescient question involving a president signing into law the, quote, American Morality Leadership Act, which limits the amount of makeup that women can wear in public, precludes wearing of short dresses, requires men to wear brown or gray attire, while those under 65 must wear button-down dress shirts with neckties. A kind of goofball, completely authoritarian act. And the question is, which argument listed below more closely reflects the constitutional argument that is most likely to succeed in court? Our listeners, I will point out, were all over the map on this. So our answers were,
wow.
A, the law is unconstitutional because it violates the Commerce Clause. You could see that because it requires a certain kind of dress and prohibits makeup, and maybe you can make that argument. B, this was your answer. The law is unconstitutional because it denies all citizens the equal protection of the law. C, the law is unconstitutional because it violates procedural due process. Or D, The law is unconstitutional because it is not rationally related to a legitimate government interest. You picked B. I am forced to tell you, however, that the answer is D.
Really?
It's a difficult, difficult question. There certainly is a difference between how men and women are being treated in this law, but both men and women are being subjected to kind of draconian Victorian era fashion requirements, even though they're different requirements. And so...
Oh, I'm appealing this one. I appeal this decision already. That can't be right.
And so the question is really best answered looking at substantive due process, because when government actions infringe upon a fundamental right, they receive strict scrutiny. Otherwise, they are subject to the rational basis review, which we've talked about, which only requires them to be rationally related to a legitimate state interest. The right to dress as you want and to have an individual appearance is generally recognized as part of the right to expression that is protected by the First Amendment and is considered part of the rights of ordered liberty that are inherent in the First Amendment. And so this kind of a law would fail to stand up to the level of scrutiny required to satisfy the due process clause. It's depriving everybody of rights, even though there are different deprivations for men over 65, for men under 65, between men, between women. Those were all sort of distractors that were in there, because the fundamental problem that this law faces is that it was depriving you of that basic right to dress as you want, right? That's really what the law was getting at. Your ability to wear clothes, which is indeed a considered part of the First Amendment. I wonder what those originalists would say to this view. Anyway, but so there's the answer.
Well, you know, I recently went to Europe, and I've decided I no longer wish to practice law. So I found myself. No, I'm just kidding. I'll come back. Have faith in me. I'll do it. Okay. 10 of 18. That's higher than 50%.
Yeah. It just got to get back up on that horse.
That was a tricky one. I don't remember anything. I've read the Constitution like, you know, once, and I don't remember anything about having to be a what was the phrase that was used in D?
Legitimate government interest. And that phrase is not found in the Constitution.
Yeah, that's why I was thrown off. Yeah. Is it some part of the jurisprudence since then or something?
Exactly. Okay. It's part of how...
Well, I'm an originalist, so I say that B, I'm changing... What if I do that? If I change to originalism, is B right?
Well, fortunately, the makers of the test view originalism in the same way that
That? Okay, well, you should have mentioned that, by the way.
There we go.
As part of our Why Originalism Sucks episodes, the makers of the test, the bar, actually don't even recognize it. Interesting. Okay, well, you learn something every show, or 25 things, and I learned something, and I'll just have to come back next time. Well, which listener did a lot better than I did and was smart enough to not fall for that trick answer B?
Well, and again, let me say, we had listeners guess A, B, C, and D. There were only a couple folks who picked D. One of them was Mike the Infidel at Board Infidel on Twitter, who says, "My answer is D. I don't see any rational government interest in establishing the fashion police." Well, Mike,
Didn't either. I just didn't think that was in the Constitution. Gosh, I haven't read up on all the jurisprudence.
Just wait for President Pence. I am sure you will change your answer. But for now, you are right. Thomas was wrong. And everyone should hit up at Board Infidel on Twitter. Send him some love. Send him some messages. Congratulations for being this week's winner on Thomas Takes the Bar Exam.
Gosh, Andrew, you didn't have to rub it in another time. All right. Well, there you have it. Thanks for listening, as always. Thanks for pledging over at patreon.com/law. And thanks for they got the early answer, right? They get the early answer every week, as well as the Lot Awful movies. So thanks for that, and we will have to see you on Friday.
Stop breaking the law, asshole!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
If you're in business, you probably have a website, but can your site handle your growth? How many visitors before your site slows down or crashes? What about storage and data security? From web hosting to virtual servers, Pear Networks provides the online infrastructure you need to start, grow, and flourish. When it comes to security and updates, don't worry, we've got you covered. Our 24/7 US-based customer support is the best in the industry. No frustrating chatbots or sitting on hold for hours. Check out pear.com today to learn more. That's PAIR.com.